Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy and related fields to talk about how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Wompold, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Jerome Wakefield, PhD. Jerome is a professor of social work at New York University, as well as a member of the American Academy of Social Work and Social Welfare, and has sat on editorial boards for the Clinical Social Work Journal and Evolutionary Psychology. He is the author of more than 300 publications appearing in journals in psychology, philosophy, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and social work, and a number of books, including The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder, which was named Best Psychology Book of 2007 by the Association of American Publishers. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. CarePaths provides free tools to help therapists as well as clients benefit from the power of measurement-based care to improve therapy outcomes. Visit CarePaths.com to start your free trial, and clients should look for the free Making Therapy Better app, now available for iPhone and Android. And now, without further ado, Episode 17 of Making Therapy Better, What is a Mental Disorder? With Jerome Wakefield, PhD.
Well, good morning, Jerry. This is a real pleasure to be able to talk to you today about diagnosis. As clinicians, and also as researchers, diagnosis is an important topic, and one that is much discussed. And when I'm writing articles or thinking about various topics, I go to your papers to get a deep conceptual and historical understanding of how we got to where we are in terms of diagnosis. And in preparation for today, I went back and read some of your articles, as well as the World Psychiatry article on diagnosis. And it's fascinating to understand this at a deeper level. So today we have the chance to dive in a bit deeper at some of these topics.
Terrific.
As I mentioned, clinicians whom I talk to are ambivalent about DSM. Some are quite enamored with it. They are very careful and conscientious to make what they think is a very accurate and reflective diagnosis. I've been in case conferences where very expert clinicians argue about a particular diagnosis. Then you have, of course, the critics who say, well, these are arbitrary categories. They really don't describe adequately the distress that clients feel. It's kind of one category fits a certain type of patient without understanding life events and personality and so forth. The frequent criticism you hear, well, two patients with the same diagnosis might not share any symptom. And that's possible for major depressive disorder, of course. But reading your work really emphasized for me the bigger issue is the demarcation of what is a mental disorder and what is not a mental disorder. So take us through a bit about that conceptual problem, and we'll get into what are the consequences of that discussion. But just to start off, what is a mental disorder and how is it different from a non-mental disorder? Everyday distress, for instance.
Okay. If I may, before I actually go to that conceptual issue, just to address a couple of things you said that I think are, interesting and important. These criticisms, of course, there's much wrong, and I've spent a lot of my career criticizing the DSM as well, but trying to defend what's good about it. And I think just to mention a couple of things that you mentioned, The idea that different symptoms might represent the same underlying problem is one that goes back 2,500 years. Yeah. There's no question. I mean, just use common sense. Think about COVID. Take a recent example. There were like 18 symptoms or so listed by the CDC, and any two of those, if you had it, were prima facie evidence that you might well have COVID. Do you know the number of combinations that is? That's an enormous number of combinations. So it's not so much whether there are different symptoms that can represent the same disorder. It's more, are we getting it right about the cohesion of certain symptoms as likely identifying the same underlying problem? That's a real issue, which we'll get to. On DSM, and before I go into mental disorder, one more point. On DSM, yes, there's a lot wrong with it. But I think, especially for younger folks in our field, it's easy not to appreciate how much DSM did for our field. Mm-hmm. When DSM was created, the modern DSM system of criteria for disorders back in 1980, led by Robert Spitzer, the field was under siege. Anti-psychiatry was prevalent with a global skepticism about whether, and this will get us into our topic, whether there is such a thing as mental disorder. The idea being that, based on one theory or another, everybody just acts the way they do. Behavior isn't subject to the disorder idea. Mm-hmm. That's a use, as Thomas Saz put it, that's a metaphor for physical disorder that isn't even legitimate. It's completely mm-hmm. nonsensical. And many others critique this, both in Europe and in America. People were not applying for psychiatric residencies in the same number. There were all sorts of serious pressures on our field. The DSM was an attempt to address all of those criticisms, including the fact that it is a reality that psychiatric diagnosis was extremely unreliable. You put three professionals in an office with somebody, do an interview, and then you ask them confidentially afterwards, what was the diagnosis? Literally, I don't mean this metaphorically, I mean this literally, you would get one saying, no real mental disorder in this person, another person saying they were psychoneurotic, and a final one saying they were somewhat psychotic. So the field was in need of a revamping and making it more scientific. DSM attempted to do that. It attempted to address all of these criticisms by creating more reliable, a lot of interpretation still goes into it, but more reliable criteria that could be used, by trying to define mental disorder, which is where we're heading here in a moment, to define mental disorder so that it was a legitimate medical category, and generally then to legitimate the field. And I think historically, this is a bit of a global judgment. I'm sure historians will have more to say. But globally, in my lifetime, watching what's happened, I think it succeeded, basically. That is, post-DSM-3 to our time now, the mental health field has gained enormous respect, has enormous power, has enormous public subsidy. You and I are in a respected, successful, well-funded field, partly because of DSM-3, I would say. Things that could have gone in a very different direction if these various criticisms hadn't been addressed. Now, the basic problem back then, the deepest problem, was, is there such a thing as mental disorder? So what is a mental disorder? And, here you have to do a little philosophy, I'm afraid. And Bob Spitzer, actually, when he was leading the DSM-3 attempt, was doing a little philosophy. Scientists do a little philosophy when they have problems that can't be solved just empirically. And he had just come out of the argument about homosexuality and getting homosexuality out of the manual. And he had tried to understand what is a mental disorder. Why would I not classify homosexuality as a disorder? He wanted to make a legitimate conceptual argument. So in life, there's a lot of negative things, okay, just to be blunt about it. A lot, we suffer in all sorts of ways, emotionally and physically. So what is the difference between a medical disorder and all these other bad things that can happen? And what's interesting is the judgments about disorder, even though we don't really still understand how the mind works, we don't understand what the brain is doing when each of these feelings occurs. We're in a I hate to say it because everybody likes to feel modern and like we're in a time of progress. We're actually in a pretty primitive state right now in terms of our understanding. DSM-5 had the idea that it was going to create biomarkers and biological criteria for every disorder. There's exactly zero in the whole manual. Well, maybe narcolepsy. There's one or two possible exceptions. But the point is, we don't understand. So how of all the bad things that happen, do we recognize disorders? And the answer is basically, of course, a disorder in the medical sense has to be something that's harmful. Everybody, most thinkers agree. If you have some little quirk that's an oddity, that's not necessarily a disorder. That may be an anomaly. People have all sorts of little things go wrong during, growth, where you have little oddities. Then that's not a medical disorder. That's just an anomaly. But what makes something a disorder is that it's not only harmful, but that it is a failure of something in our bodies or minds to do what it was biologically designed to do. Now, that's the distinction that I've argued for, and I think Bob Spitzer had it implicitly in mind, although he never clarified it, and he ended up agreeing with me. So I think, and it's widely used now in the field, what I call the harmful dysfunction approach to disorder. So to have a disorder, you have to have, of course, it has to be harmful, but it also isn't any form of harm. It has to be harm due to something going wrong with some mechanism inside of you that was biologically designed to perform some function. Now, one place where this differs from, let's say, the antipsychiatrist like Zaz, is he was unwilling to simply say that there are emotional, intellectual, mental functions that we could recognize that were going wrong. And he said, there has to be a physical lesion. Even in physical medicine, we haven't identified a lot of physical lesions yet. So if you look at the chapters of DSM, what I would argue is, you look at disorders of eating, disorders of sex, disorders of sleep, disorders of thought, obviously psychosis, disorders of mood, depression, and mania, and so on. Each chapter is really an attempt to say what we as clinicians over thousands of years have observed that seem to be, to us, failures of psychological functions, failures to do what they were biologically designed to do. If you have a panic attack when you go to the grocery store and there's no threat, our intuition is that fear was designed and panic was designed to protect us from danger and should have some connection to danger. If it's afflicting you without any threat that you're aware of, even subliminally perceiving, then it's something going wrong with the fear system. It's stuck in stuck, so to speak. Similarly with depression, these are normal emotions, fear and sadness. But if they go wrong, then there can be a disorder. So you have to make that distinction between them doing what they were biologically designed to do and something going wrong with them, which is a difficult distinction to make because of our ignorance, both about the mechanisms and about the evolutionary history of our species. and how we were biologically designed to function, and the fact that we're in a very new, odd environment that isn't the one we were biologically designed to cope with. Mm. So that's the basic idea. So let's look at a couple of distinctions. So fear, intense fear, isn't a disorder if there's a real threat, an imminent threat. And terror isn't even a disorder if there's an imminent threat to your life, say. But there's no threat and you feel chronic anxiety, that becomes generalized anxiety disorder, or periodic terror and overwhelming, you know, heart rapidly beating fear, that becomes panic disorder. If you are sad because you've lost something, if you are sad because things that you aspire to look out of your reach for some reason suddenly, or relationships go bad, all sorts of reasons why people feel sad. Whereas in normal sadness, you retreat, you think it through, you redirect your resources, and over time, it just ameliorates as you constructively approach whatever it is that the loss was, or you reintegrate it in your system so that you can function despite the loss. In pathological depression, that doesn't happen. In pathological depression, the symptoms become so profound that there's no real plausible explanation of it as being even remotely adaptive or being part of how we're biologically designed to function. And it may go on. In fact, 2,500 years ago, they already said that melancholia, their word for depression, was if it went on too long or was too severe. Those are the two things that triggered them to think something has gone wrong. And I just want to emphasize contrasas and all these. Anything that is biologically designed or humanly designed, think of your printer or your computer or anything else, or your pen, anything that is designed biologically can go wrong. So in that sense, anything about us that's part of our human nature can potentially have a disorder of that system, depending on what happens. The problem is always, as was pointed out by the French philosopher and historian of ideas, Michel Foucault, more than anybody, he harped on this, maybe excessively at times. Societies then use our idea of what's natural and normal and designed. They tweak it and they distort it in their own direction so as to make us more supportive of social values that may not be biologically designed. We have to, as mental health professionals, to be honest with our patients. We have to have a certain amount of courage in saying, you know, this may not be what people say you should be like, but this is what human beings are like. People do get sad and maybe don't want to go to work for a few days when they lose somebody or something horrible happens. This is not necessarily a disorder. This is something that's normal functioning within our very odd environment that's putting pressures on you. Does that help with the concept of mental disorder?
It does. Very, very helpful. Fascinating.
If I could say one more thing, Bruce. So no matter how harmful something is, this is a very important point. No matter how harmful something is, if it's biologically designed, we don't think it's a disorder. So my favorite example is sleep. I happen to be writing an article now about sleep disorders. Sleep is, if you think about it in the, you know, bizarre way that I think about these things, if you think about it, sleep is the most harmful, other than maybe aging and death. I mean, sleep is the most harmful condition of the human race. It takes away 1/3 of everybody's lifespan. Everybody. So you're rendered periodically hallucinating and partially paralyzed. If this wasn't a biologically designed thing, we would label it the worst scourge of humankind. But the context, the history, what we know about other animals, about ourselves, everything supports the notion that, of course, this is basically biologically designed. Now, we don't understand why. To this day, we don't understand why we have to sleep and why so many organisms, even primitive organisms, seem to have a sleep period or something like a sleep period. So we don't understand the function actually yet. A lot of theories. We don't understand really how it works. But the context enables us to identify it not as a mass disorder, but as biological design. And so nobody would say that just sleeping is a disorder. So I'm just trying to illustrate that it really is that biological design intuition underlying this, not just how bad it is overall. Sorry, go ahead.
No, this is great. So that so many things to focus on, but let's focus for a while on this idea of biological design, because it sounds very medical in a sense. This is the biology, but it's the kind of biological design includes psychological processes that are protective or adaptive for the human organism. So it's not the immune system, for example, which is more, we think, in terms of a medical purview, but it's a psychological system. So in the mental health field, and as you say, the DSM-3 and onwards really benefited our field tremendously when we think about it, particularly in the United States, but in other Western countries as well. But this idea of biological design sounds like mental disorders are under the medical domain rather than other domains. Yet we know psychological therapies delivered by a variety of professions in many instances are as effective as what we think of as medical interventions, and psychiatry's become very biologically oriented. So what is this? What are the implications of this for the mental health delivery system in terms of the harmful dysfunction idea?
Right. I think so. There's several points there. I mean, I think, first of all, your first point that you made has to be underscored, highlighted. Namely, when I use the term biological design, I am not, how should I say, biological is used in two different senses that can get confused. Biological, sometimes you're referring to anatomy and physiology. And of course, that is biological, but biological also has a broader meaning, an evolutionary meaning, how we were designed to function, and that includes our psychological functioning. So psychological functioning, although it's rooted in physiological brain functioning and so on, also has its own level of meanings that really are what drive us socially and personally. We are meaning oriented creatures. And so when I say biological design, just to underscore your point, I am not reducing things to physiology and anatomy at all. I believe that the meaning system that we have is the locus of many mental psychological conditions, both normal distress, obviously, but also even disorders. And so it's entirely possible to focus on that psychological level. Now, I think the idea that because, I'll come back to the medicalization, but I think I should say this right away, that the idea that because DSM is medicalizing psychological dysfunction in this broad sense I'm using, it really doesn't have anything to do with the history that surgery and medication, let's say, are considered the quintessential medical interventions. Medicine is defined by the nature of the problem that it's addressing, which is the failure of biologically designed mechanisms to work. If tomorrow we found something that's not surgery and not medication that cures cancer, would anybody doubt that doctors would use it right away?
Yeah.
Keep in mind that Freud, who was, among other things, a medical person, he took over from a direct neurological interpretation of neurosis and gave a psychological interpretation of it. And, you know, many, many medical people learn psychoanalysis and still do. Why? Because if you have symptoms that are clearly disorder symptoms, they fall within the medical realm, even if they're psychological. And whatever works is what you're going to use. You're not limited to surgery. Mm-hmm. So I see, there's a separation here conceptually between the goal that makes it medical, namely whatever is a disorder, and the means, which may not be the traditional medical means, and in psychotherapy they are not. Now, let me just also say before going on that psychotherapy, it's obvious, I guess, to anybody who practices in the field, painfully obvious. Psychotherapists do not just treat disorders. I mean, yeah. The average person that somebody asks me about that's coming in for therapy sounds like they have dysphoria about their life. And there's nothing necessarily disordered about that. We live in a very different environment than the one that we evolved in. We don't have close, small groups that we're part of. We may feel isolated. We have multiple hierarchical systems that we're struggling in that we may not succeed in, that we may feel disappointed about. We have all sorts of ideas about what we're supposed to do coming down from our society in various ways. So I psychiatrists recognize this, even the classic neo-Kreplinians who focused on biology recognized that psychiatry often deals with normal distress. It often deals with other kinds of problems of potentiating human possibility and so on. So I think we should start understanding that we have a wide purview, but as you point out, the medicalization in DSM meant that reimbursement in our culture, especially in the United States, or elsewhere to some degree, but not as much. I mean, we have an extreme system here. That medicalization meant that passing the threshold of it being a disorder is necessary in most instances to get insurance reimbursement. Mm-hmm. Now, before getting into the arguments and other issues you raised, I just have to say personally, this is an abomination. I mean, it's not only cruel, it's not only self-defeating, because just to take an example, when you have a marital couple come in that's on the verge of maybe separating, they have children, and the conflict is intense, but there's no disorder. I'm saying literally. I'm saying by a literal analysis, do either of them have anything going wrong psychologically? No, they're distressed because of this horrible situation. And people's emotions get very intense of anger, hurt, sadness. So the typical therapist will, frankly, find a way of diagnosing one of them or both of them with anxiety or depression or something in order to justify reimbursement. This is terrible. And our system, so a goal of the field, of all of us, you and I and everybody, should be eventually to have some kind of system that allows for reimbursement with honest diagnosis of extreme distress due to a life circumstance or something like that. So that's where we should be heading. Now, the fact that we're not there leads to several issues. One issue you didn't raise is the ethical issue. The fact is that I call this the clinician's dilemma. It's so common people I know in the field, it's something that faces them every single day. Somebody comes in, they're depressed in that usual sense of depression. We have two different meanings of mental health these days, right? We have mental health literally, like something's gone wrong and you have a disorder, literally. And we have mental health in the sense that you're not optimally functioning, you're not happy, or, you know, something like that, which has nothing to do with health per se. So, but it has to do with social ideals and social demands and values and what we care about and where we want to be. The average clinician will figure out a way of putting that person under the DSM system. Now, this isn't an ethical seminar, and I'm not going to argue right here. But just think about it for a second. Do you really want a system where therapists routinely basically say what they don't believe is true in order to get reimbursement for people who deserve help and need help and that can get help with modern therapeutic techniques? It's not a system conducive to honesty about diagnosis. So I would say that's one issue we must address in the future. In any event, so that's one of the consequences of medicalization. Now, medicalization was partly designed to address a broader social issue. Well, when you and I were growing up or something, I don't know, the Rolling Stones had their song, Mother's Little Helper, right? Yeah. She really doesn't have a disorder, but she takes her little yellow Valium pill every day in order to get through her day. Valium and other, you know, kind of medications like it were being given out in such quantities that I read one study, it was astonishing, that was done then, that 25% of all medical appointments, no matter what the medical problem, physical or emotional, would have a Valium or another derivative, another diazepine, given out in addition to whatever else they were given. So these things were given out in such quantities for normal distress that there was a congressional hearing. The FDA adjusted its criteria for approving drugs to require a biomedical condition. There's a whole scandal about this. So the issue is, how do we walk that tightrope between wanting to help people in distress, open up those floodgates to normal distress that our society is so good at creating, without it becoming a kind of almost abusive thing where we over-medicalize, over-treat, and maybe flood the system to the point it's unsustainable? It's a tricky problem. But the most thing that I can say that I can add to this, I'm sorry, did you want to?
Well, you raise a good point. This is not just an issue in mental health care, but it's an issue in primary care, for instance. And absolutely, you were talking about the Valium, but now it's SSRIs. Exactly. We all have stories of people that go in with some kind of what they think is a physical problem and end up with an SSRI because the primary care physician prescribed that. And I forget what the statistic is, but about 60% of people that present to the primary care physician do not have a medical diagnosis. And so it's not simply a problem of the mental health system.
That's absolutely right. In fact, for depression, it's really GPs that are diagnosing it and giving out the drugs. And in particular, in the medical system, the non-therapeutic medical system, you have many, many cases. I was always frightened when I saw the statistic. You have many, many cases of people being assigned or being prescribed antidepressants. One consultation, no follow-up. Now, you and I both know, I mean, we're oriented towards therapy maybe more, but, and it does just as well as medication, but we both also know that that's not a good way to give out antidepressants if you're going to give them out. Very often, the first one does not work or there's negative side effects, you need to be monitoring to see, titrating it depending on the system. I mean, this is something that does have to be followed up. So the fact that there's more and more being given out, it sort of does remind you of the Valium scandal back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. So, well, the other part of that, because we all have our pet peeves here, but in clinical trials of SSRIs, you get clinical management once a week or once every other week. And we know that clinical management is part of the effect of antidepressants. Yet when antidepressants are prescribed in medical care, you don't get that very helpful clinical management. Somebody who cares for you, inquires about how you're doing, and is supportive and empathic. We forget that that's an important part of drug treatment.
Absolutely. So, and just as an aside, the literature on negative side effects has really exploded in recent years. It was kind of downplayed for a long time. It was more like you talked about it over dinner. Gee, my patient feels bad. It's not just their negative affect, but their positive affect that's been suppressed. So you get all these various things. And now that literature really is exploding and suggesting there really does have to be monitoring and care. But let me circle back for a second about your question about medicalization. The problem with medicalization, leaving aside all the ethical issues and so on, the problem with medicalization is that because of the concept of mental disorder or disorder, which we discussed earlier, to label something as a disorder presumes that something is going wrong inside the person. Mm-hmm. It thus focuses the attention on the individual's intrapsychic or internal functioning. Now, the problem with this is that for many of our psychotherapeutic patients, what's happening outside is just as or more important than what's happening inside. In fact, for many of our patients, helping them understand that they're having a relatively normal emotional response to an unacceptable situation that they can then act to deal with could be the best thing you could do for them. We have patients, you know, I see reports of patients who get this and say, look, I don't need therapy or medication. What I need is a job or something like that. So we have a range of considerations that need to be attended to. And the problem with medicalization is it, and there's evidence on this, by the way, studies of how therapists think once they decide there is a disorder versus not a disorder. Mm. Once they decide there is a disorder, they tend to narrow the possible interventions that they will consider. And that's a real problem in a field where the nature of the causes of distress are so variable. And so I think that is one of the main problems. I remember, and the field has difficulty accepting this because of all the reasons we discussed earlier, that there's a commitment to disorder. There was a whole conference held at NIMH one time about some articles I wrote about conduct disorder in adolescence. And the articles basically made a completely common sense point, but since I used data, people looked at it instead of the common sense, right? And what the argument was basically, very simple, that in our more deprived, challenging communities, we have many teenagers that are diagnosed with conduct disorder as a mental disorder because of the antisocial behavior they engage in. But if you actually look at their histories, there aren't any like psychopathic-like traits. What it is these kids are in dangerous environments. They perceive the environment as dangerous, and they join gangs. And then they're socialized into certain gang behaviors that are antisocial. And so it's a very much a social and self-protective, it's a complicated sequence of events that lead them to satisfy the overblown DSM criteria for conduct disorder. And At that conference, I gave these papers for about 20 experts on researchers on conduct disorder. By the end of it, almost every one of them agreed with me, but a few held out. And I said to you, how can you hold out? This is so, leaving aside the data, it's so commonsensical. And the answer was frightening, frankly. The answer was, if I said I believe this, NIMH wouldn't fund me anymore because they would be funding something that's not a mental disorder. So one negative effect of the medicalization is that it's constrained research by looking only inside and by, you know, they look at social determinants, but it's constrained research, it's constrained clinicians. And while we want to attend to mental disorders as being probably in most cases the most severe instances of distress and impairment, our society owes it to other people as well to help them. So there's a lot of resistance to this, but in the end, the medicalization constrains us because of the assumptions built in to the concept of mental disorder.
Well, let's talk about the research for a minute, because as you know, that's of interest to me, and you hit on a very important point, is that the DSM, the medicalization of mental disorder, as well as funding priorities, have really emphasized research on particular disorders. But it goes a little further, because the disorders are defined in terms of the symptoms, sometimes signs, but mostly symptoms. So the primary measures and outcomes in these studies are symptoms, when it might be that the symptoms are, as you say, part of the biological system, which is giving a signal to the organism to do something. And you raised the example of reaction to a distressing event, the death of a loved one, the loss of a job, is a depressive reaction often, which is a time to reflect, to plan, and the evolutionary psychologists talk about the depressive reaction as an adaptive one, and as you say, this idea of dysfunction. So in the research, we've really focused, in my opinion, too much on the symptoms and forgetting about the person in the context, well-being, quality of life, relationships, and so forth. So talk about, just to follow up on that, because I think you probably agree, but at one point you say one of the things that happened in the evolution of diagnosis was the unfortunate coordination of research and clinical practice. And I'm really intrigued by that, because I would think that that's a good thing, right? Yeah. We want to research the things that are disturbing people. And right. Yet you looked at some negative consequences. So talk about the research versus clinical practice dilemma.
Okay. Let me go back. But first, let me just, what you just said, I think I need to correct it a little bit.
Good.
What you read, and I understand what you're referring to, I was asking whether that was a mistake. In a way, it was brilliant. I mean, this is what Bob Spitzer figured out. He said, look, you know, let's put clinical, as you're saying, let's make research relevant to clinicians, and clinicians care about research by making the criteria the same for diagnosis in a clinical context and for sample selection in research. Mm-hmm. Now, what I said in that section of that paper was that this had one negative consequence that I was worried about. So one of the problems with DSM, I think we've hinted at it in this discussion several times already, The problem is the categories are there. Okay, there's categories describing what seem like basic problems with mental functioning. But the criteria that are used to diagnose them, in my view, and I'm not, you know, I mean, psychiatrists aren't conceptual analysts. They're not that good, maybe, at saying what's necessary and sufficient to get at what they're trying to get at. But the criteria, in my view, are very often not well formulated in a way that makes them much broader than actual disorder. So in one sense, that's good because we can diagnose all this distress under these disorder categories. It's kind of a complicated web of issues here. But in another sense, it's over-medicalizing distress and over-medicalizing people. So a question one might ask is, how did we get to a point where these criteria are so broad? And a correlated question is then the one about research criteria corresponding with clinical criteria. And there the question is, if our research criteria are so good, why aren't we making more progress? Why aren't we figuring out new treatments all the time? Why aren't we redefining disorders and finding out, oh, depression is actually three different disorders that lead to the same apparent kind of final pathway of sadness. Now we can treat each of them or think about each of them separately. We don't seem to be making the kind of progress that we thought we would make, on the one hand, in research. And in the clinical domain, it seems like the criteria are all over the map. And my research has focused on showing that they're all over the map and carefully looking at criteria and showing that there's subgroups in there that just don't seem to be disordered at all. And we can come back to that about depression if you want. But that's so what I was saying in that section of the paper was, yes, it's very good that Spitzer did this, because as a clinician, if somebody comes into my office with depressive symptoms, this wasn't the case before DSM. Before DSM, you had behaviorists saying one thing, biologicalists saying another thing, cognitivists. The research was all over the map with different definitions. Now, if somebody comes into my office and has five out of those nine symptoms so that I can classify them, I can go to an enormous literature and I can see, yeah, medication helps maybe 20% of the people, but therapy does just as well, if not better, in the long term. And I can look at, you know, how does CBT do? How does psychodynamic do? There's an immense literature addressing precisely within these symptom domains the kind of client that's come in my door. We never had that before. So that's an enormous advantage. Mm-hmm. Now, one problem you pointed out is that this symptom focus sometimes leaves out the person. So we have all these cases where it's been demonstrated, ADHD, where the outcome studies focus on the symptoms, but what the student really needs is to figure out how to succeed in school, and that takes somebody helping them with that. Getting rid of the symptoms by itself or lowering the symptoms with stimulants doesn't necessarily do that for them. Mm-hmm. Similarly with depression, therapy, even if you're getting medication, may take away some of your symptoms, 20% chance, but if you have somebody helping you how to actually figure out your life, that increases the outcome in what matters to you. So, and other treatments may treat symptoms, but actually hurt your life. I remember we studied sex therapy way back when there was a feminist-oriented sex therapy in which you separated the couple and treated the woman for her problems. And then she got back in the relationship. And by doing that, it may have had the greatest of intentions, you know, and feminist issues are critical for our whole period of history. But the effect was that her hopes for the relationship often were dashed upon the separation that occurred when she underwent therapy without her partner about something that was so intimately partner related. So there's all sorts of ways that you need to go beyond symptoms when you are, you know, treating someone. Now I lost, I was going back to a point of yours that I will remember in a second. I got off on all these examples. Yeah,
no, there's so much interesting things to talk about.
So the answer is yes, you must go beyond symptoms. Symptom relief does help. People care about that. With certain disorders, it's urgent. To be honest, during a certain period of my life, I had a disorder called generalized anxiety disorder. And I can tell you the suffering when you have chronic, unrelenting high anxiety is just enormous. And I was very, very happy for those symptoms to go down. And of course, then to consider what the background issues are. Yes, but what I was going to say, I remember, is this. Whatever diagnosis you're doing, whatever all that other stuff is, you've got to be prepared to say to your client, look, these symptoms are actually a normal biologically designed response. Maybe in your case, a disorder has occurred where this biological response has gotten so intense and gotten stuck like an open valve, you know, and in some sense, it's not going right. You're not normally recovering from it, or it's getting more profound than it ever should. Maybe, but maybe also you're having an intense emotional response to a situation which triggers this normally, but, you know, you're having trouble dealing with it. So there's actually evidence starting to come out, by the way, that initial studies of this evolutionary way of approaching things, that it actually helps clients, that clients feel happier about therapy. If you explain to them that it's not bizarre to feel intense sadness when, say, an opportunity comes along that you think is yours and it's taken away from you, that this is our nature as biological and psychological creatures, the question is, how do you deal with it? How do you go on? How do you integrate it and learn from it and build on it?
Well, I think that's a really important point. It isn't simply an explanation. This is a biological adaptive system that's gone wrong, but it's a signal about what that system is telling you and what you might need to do in your life. So depression. So yeah, this is, we've evolved to, in the face of distressing events, become less activated and more introspective, problem solving. This is your opportunity to figure out why your relationships, let's say, end dramatically at a certain point. So it's not just the system gone a little bit haywire. It's a sign that it's telling you something that's really important.
I think that's I think that's one of the most important points. And to my shock, it's not something that people want to hear sometimes, because there is such a prejudice about it. I had an experience where I was, you know, scheduled to be interviewed on a TV show about depression. I showed up at the studio and they, you know, these shows, they pre-interview you to sort of figure out if you're going to destroy the ratings or not. And so during the pre-interview, I said exactly what you're saying. I said, one point I'm going to make is it's not necessarily a disorder, that sadness, this is about depression, that sadness is telling you something, that something you value, that it's telling you about your values, about what you care about in life, and that something isn't going the way that you deeply imagine you want your life to go. And so you have to now think about that. Do you want to change your goals? Do you want to fight for this? Do you want to do something different? So when I said that to the pre-interviewer, she went and talked to the actual anchor of this thing, and they canceled my appearance. I'm serious. They canceled my appearance because he said, what, you're going to tell our audience that depression is useful, that it actually tells them something versus just a disorder? So thankfully, I had many other interviews where I could say that. But the point I'm trying to make is getting this across in our era when depression is and other conditions, PTSD and so on, are played up as disorders that are triggered by almost anything is difficult. And trying to say what we are as human beings that may not fit our current social idealizations or demands or values, those are different things. We want to live up to our society's values very often, most of us, but it's different than ill health. Mm-hmm. Not to happen to be somebody who's stoic and can go into work the next day after a major loss. So normal variation of human beings is enormous, and our field needs to recognize that enormous variation that's still normal and not, you know, yet a disorder, in order to support people in getting the messages that their emotions are telling them.
Well, we certainly have a society that focuses on quick fixes, I think. And you know, in the United States, we have advertisements for medications, and that often reinforces that. We haven't, you know, we've kind of talked about society as uniform, but we have to think about, and it's implicit in our discussion, cultural aspects of this, because the cultural, much of our response to various events is cultural, and it's important for therapists to understand that. Terry, we only have a few minutes left. I want to talk about a couple of issues. We may have to have you back because this is so fascinating. But let's take major depressive disorder. Every single legitimate psychotherapy that's been tested in the clinical trials has been shown to be effective, with widely different psychological mechanisms targeted for treatment. So here's a disorder, major depressive disorder. Let's say this is somebody who's not a false positive, but they have a chronic, maybe lifelong depressive reaction. But this variety of psychological treatments with different bases being approximately equally effective, what does that say about the disorder and about how we make diagnoses?
Yeah, first of all, it's an enduringly puzzling finding. I mean, let's be honest. I understand it's been replicated. I accept it. But I have to say, it's one of those puzzles. Like, it doesn't actually make great sense to me. Now, the way that I've tried to explain it, I had an article a while ago about levels of meaning and integrating psychotherapy theories, is we are such integrated creatures psychologically that, you know, it's sort of like different therapy theories approach this system at different points. But once you're in the system, you know, everything's the collarbone's connected to the arm bone or whatever. Everything's connected so that you're likely to get a global response if you can actually affect any link in this complicated system. We are behaviorally conditioned. We know that from thousands of experiments. We also know that we operate cognitively. I mean, you send me an email saying, be here at 10, and I'm here at 10. What happened? Do I need to do psychoanalysis to figure out how I managed to do such a miraculous thing? No, one belief changed. And we know from cognitive science that much semantic processing happens below the conscious level. We know emotions are going on all the time, and that emotion is particularly useful in terms of highlighting certain memories that may be particularly important to us, and so on. So the way I think about it is we're dealing with one system. Each, you know, the old elephant. But different parts of the elephant. So I think as long as you enter into that system and can affect a change, you are affecting a change in the overall system, which you're all working on. So that's one way of looking at it. And I do think the data shows, and you might be more on top of this than I am. I think the data does show that there is an effect of technique. It's not just zero. But of course, the standard way of interpreting this is that a good therapeutic relationship is the main variable that's operating.
Well, that's very true. The relationship, and I think the evidence is pretty strong, both from psychotherapy, but also from the placebo research, that the relationship with the healer is healing in itself. But the actual...
But Bruce, let me just say one more thing. It is exactly the sort of problem that I deal with in these false positives. If you have a category where half or two-thirds of the people don't really have a disorder and one-third do, and you're creating a sample, especially these drug company samples that are designed to have relatively moderate conditions so that you can show quickly that your drug has an effect and you get all these results, it's hard to know what the hell they mean, honestly, because you have a mix. And you get a tremendous placebo effect with depression, as you well know, and many of these other conditions. So actually, I would say these problems in validity and these problems with placebo response may also be undermining or flooding the ability to see finer distinctions in the treatment. That's one speculation I have.
That's a very interesting one, and right down the line of we have to be careful about the population studied and the context in which they're studied. This is a novel treatment. You're a special case. We have this new and fancy way to deal with it. Of course, there's going to be an expectation effect. What I was going to say is, because you talked about technique, it's more than technique. It's the actual enactment of something that's useful in your life. You know, in workshops that I do, I ask the audience how they learn not to stick a metal implement like a knife into an electric circuit. And, you know, we have conditioning, we have instrumental reinforcement, we have vicarious learning. Well, we didn't learn it. For the most part, we learn it because somebody, a trusted person, told us not to do it. And this is what therapists do. They persuade somebody to do something that's really helpful. Now, cognitive behaviorists persuade people to do something very different than psychodynamic therapists or interpersonal therapists, but they all have that common, that we're going to do something in your life that's more adaptive than you have been doing. And that's learning. And it's, you know, sometimes we make psychotherapy very complicated sounding.
Yeah, so your idea would be that, let me put the idea slightly differently, that the different techniques or theoretical approaches are different ways to get people to do something adaptive.
Yes.
I mean, so that in a way, that's a final pathway that unites all of them. And I remember, you know, I was very impressed with the idea that behaviorists reduce anxiety by bringing you closer to the anxiety-provoking object gradually. Psychoanalysts reduce anxiety by bringing you closer, by uplifting your defenses and bringing you closer to what internally you fear. And I think the idea that there are these common ways of getting you to do something that is going to change the situation is a very useful one, actually. I like that as a final pathway for explaining the common effectiveness of different therapies.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Jerry, we're out of time, unfortunately, because I could go on for another hour or two. I have, as you know, I sent you some questions that we might consider, and we covered maybe half of them, because these are really important issues to consider on a number of different levels. We considered kind of the basic science. We've considered the medical system. We've considered various treatments and how they're effective. So fascinating areas, because this idea of diagnosis is not simply something we do to get reimbursed or argue about, but it's critical to so many areas of the understanding of and the treatment of mental disorders and distress, not just,
yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I thank you. This has been a fascinating hour. It flew by. And again, I want to thank you for showing up at 10 a.m. as you promised.
It's a better time than most, I'll tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Bruce. It's been a very, really enjoyable interchange. And, happy to continue the discussion in some way or form or other.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. With CarePaths Connect, clinicians can enroll their clients in automated measurement-based care and create a digital front door for their practice. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. If you are currently in therapy and want to know how to get the most out of your treatment, check out the free Making Therapy Better app and visit makingtherapybetter.com.